Two patches of darkness moved from Jason's shadow to the water behind the yacht and turned into black replicas of Albert's small vehicle. "Sorry, Al," Jason said, his voice softening. "We'll be making our own arrangements, but thank you. Farah, we need to go." Without waiting, Jason jumped onto one of the vehicles and it launched off towards the island, spraying water behind it. Farah gave Albert an apologetic smile.
"Sorry," she said. "He can be a bit dramatic."
"What's going on?" Albert asked.
"No idea,"
she said, and then jumped on the other black watercraft and immediately shot away. Albert shook his head and then pushed his watercraft back into the water.
"Adventurers," he muttered to himself.
Chapter 9. More Paperwork. Unlike most of the temples in Rimuros, the city's main temple of knowledge was not to be found in the temple district on the island of Liveros. Instead, it could be found on the second largest of the city's sky islands, one of the few which could be accessed by the public. The island was primarily known for being the location of the Rimuros Magic Society campus, which held ownership and control of the island. In a major city like Rimuros, the Temple of Knowledge was an important resource for the many magical researchers and had a symbiotic relationship with the Magic Society branch. Within the temple was a chamber specifically for incoming portals. A portal appeared and two people emerged before it closed behind them.
"This had best be as important as you claim," Rufus Remor said darkly. "I have my own concerns."
Rufus was tall and lean, with dark skin and a bald head. He was wearing loose clothes, having come from the humid Mistrun Delta in Greenstone.
"I am a priestess of the Goddess of Knowledge," Gabrielle Pellin told him. "I am fully aware of your concerns. You used to be more polite, Mr. Remor."
Gabrielle was no longer the teenage Iron Ranker that had been Humphrey's girlfriend. With age and rank, her already impressive looks had blossomed into dangerous beauty, with olive skin, chocolate hair, and graceful poise. She led Rufus forward, out of the chamber and into the larger temple. It was mostly comprised of a vast library covering multiple wings, each with multiple stories.
"How long have you known they were alive?" Rufus asked.
"When Jason Asano both died and came back to life, Mr. Remor, he was beyond the vision of this world's gods."
"But you knew."
"I serve the Goddess of Knowledge, Mr. Remor, not the Goddess of Assumptions. If I told you that Jason Asano was alive and I was wrong, how would you feel about that? And as for Miss Huron, that came as a surprise to even the Goddess."
"Are you saying they're already here?"
"As we speak, a local Adventure Society official is directing them to the island of Liveros."
"We're in Rimuros."
"We are. I imagine you will wish to greet them on their arrival at port."
Rufus frowned.
"I apologize, Priestess Pellin. You have done me a service only to receive discourtesy in return."
"The last member of my church you spoke with, you slapped in the face," she said, her voice tinged with amusement. "I consider discourtesy a welcome step in the right direction."
"Contact, Rufus Remor has entered communication range. Contact, Gabrielle Pellin has entered communication range." The personal watercraft Shade had taken the form of all but flew over the water. Only magic kept the ultralight vehicle from flipping over. Jason was an experienced jet ski rider, and this strange bamboo variant wasn't that different. He was in a half crouch as it skimmed over the water, moving between larger boats as he made his way into port. Jason homed in on the familiar aura like a beacon until he spotted a bald black head on the busy dockside. He conjured his cloak and launched himself into the air, then glided down to land in front of his friend. As the cloak dissolved around him, he flashed the stunned-looking Rufus a huge grin.
"G'day, bloke."
Rufus looked Jason over. The strange eyes, the aura that had yet again gone through massive changes. Now they were equal rank, Rufus had a new appreciation for its oppressiveness. As Jason's aura withdrew to a discreet state, Rufus realized Jason had unveiled it so that Rufus would sense the personal crest marked upon it.
"Farah thought I was a shapeshifter or something," Jason said.
Rufus clasped Jason in a fierce hug.
"Crikey," Jason croaked.
It's good to see you, mate, but it feels like you're trying to juice me.
Farah, Rufus said, not letting Jason go.
Look behind me, mate.
Rufus released Jason and looked out at the water. Farah was just rising from her own watercraft on wings of fire, swiftly joining them on the dock. She and Rufus joined in a wordless hug. As they did, Jason turned to the priestess.
Gabrielle? He greeted.
You are quite correct, Mr. Asano. She is not the goddess of solid deductions made on the basis of reasonable evidence.
Jason chuckled.
Still don't like me much, do you?
I am glad that you are no longer dead.
That's still goodwill, so I'll take it. I assume that your boss is responsible for getting Rufus here?
There is a brief window before the Adventure Society starts claiming the time of every portal user, including those belonging to the church. Even my trip here will last until the monster surge is done. My lady sent Rufus Ramore here as a gesture, as she had not let your friends know of your likely resurrection. Your other companions are currently indisposed, and by the time they reach Vitesse, it will be too late to bring them here immediately. They will need to make their own way to you.
They're all right, then?
They're well and together.
Jason gave Gabrielle a bow of gratitude, startling her.
Even though she already knows my gratitude, please convey my thanks to your goddess, Priestess Pellen.
I will do so, Mr. Asano.
Why did she send you too?
Jason asked.
To keep an eye on me.
You have an important task to complete, Mr. Asano.
And what do you know of that?
My goddess only told me that it is your secret to share or, and she wished to voice her strong preference on this, not to share.
Rufus and Farah came up behind him, Rufus's arm slung over Farah's shoulder. If the smile on his face had been any wider, the top half of his head would have fallen off. He clasped a hand on Jason's shoulder.
You have to tell me everything, he said. Everything.
The trio got directions from the Adventure Society port office and made their way through the city. There was a lot of personal transportation magic on display in boulevards and avenues thick with essence users. Some rode mounts, others magical carriages. Personal float discs were the most common, although there were some interesting variations. Jason was particularly taken with the ones that produced a mist that made it seem like the rider was drifting about on a cloud.
Can you do a cloud thing?
Jason asked Shade.
I can do a black cloud,
Shade said.
Never mind.
Jason, Farah said, this is not the time to be playing monkey magic.
What's monkey magic? Rufus asked.
She's talking about Sun Wukong, Jason said. It's a legend from my world.
No, Farah said. I'm talking about the old monkey TV show, as you well know.
That's not what I was thinking, Jason said.
Are you going to stand there and tell me the theme song isn't playing through your head right now?
Fine, Jason admitted. Rufus was looking at them in horror. Jason, what did you do to Farah? He asked.
It's fine, Jason said. Shade, some horses, please.
Horses.
Farah said, as three dark horses with glowing white manes and hooves were formed out of Jason's shadow.
What's wrong with horses?
Jason asked.
I thought the reason you couldn't have Shade turn into a Heidel in the other world was that your world didn't have Heidels, Farah said.
Sounds about right, Jason said.
Our world doesn't have horses.
You probably just haven't seen them, Jason said. They're probably around somewhere.
Shade?
Farah asked.
I am merely the vessel, Miss Huron. The actual power belongs to Mr. Asano, and any limitations he has or chooses to impose are his own.
Come on, Jason said hastily as he mounted one of the horses. Can't hang about all day.
On the upstairs balcony of a cafe just outside Liveros Temple District, a table was covered in plates.
This is fantastic, Jason mumbled happily, around a forkful of food. I've been living almost entirely on spirit coins for the last couple of years.
Because of the food shortages you mentioned, Rufus said, and Jason nodded.
His world was never equipped for monsters, Farrah said. Once the concentrated localized monster surges started happening, much of the trade and transport infrastructure collapsed.
It sounds like your world saw some dark days, Rufus said solemnly.
We'll explain more once we're a little more secluded, Farrah said.
Jason mumbled his agreement.
Let's just focus on the happy stuff for now, he said. Are there any more of those dumplings?
What we should focus on is getting ourselves organized, Farrah said. As it stands, we don't have any place to stay, and we remain, so far as I'm aware, dead, as far as any records are concerned anyway.
We need to update your status with the Adventure Society, Rufus said. The others will be looking for that.
So you met Dawn, Jason said to Rufus. How's she doing?
She seemed normal, Rufus said. Whatever that means for a diamond ranker, they appear how they want to appear.
Dawn took a little while to loosen up, but she got there, Jason said. Mostly I think it was her boss's idea. Wanted her to reconnect with her mortality.
You're about as mortal as it gets, Farrah told Jason,
which is odd for a man who keeps coming back from the dead.
I was expecting something more ominous, Jason said. Skull motif, lots of black.
No, Farrah said, that's more you and the god of undeath.
Rufus, Farrah, and Jason were standing outside of what looked like a rather nice memorial centre with lots of tasteful white stone and neatly manicured gardens. It was a long way from what Jason expected from the Temple of Death. The trio stepped onto the grounds to make their way through the pleasant garden pathways to the main building. As soon as he set foot on the path, Jason froze.
You have entered a spirit domain. You may not claim this territory as a spirit domain unless it is surrendered to you.
Jason cautiously probed with his aura, but got no negative reactions.
What's wrong? Rufus asked. I'll tell you later, Jason said. It's fine. Are these gardens laid out as an array?
Good eye, Farrah said. The dead are stored in temples of death, so they all have arrays of ritual formations to protect against any necromantic power, be it inadvertent or deliberate.
You can get accidental zombies? Jason asked.
It's magic, Rufus said. You can get anything.
So, does the god of undeath get a temple? Jason asked. It'd be more of a secret thing that people try and wipe out as soon as they find it, right?
Yes, Rufus said. It's the same for most of the purely harmful gods, although undeath is one of the worst. They have to hide them because the Adventure Society, the churches, and any local authorities will raise them to the ground on discovery. Unless the local authorities are in league with them, which is always a mess.
That was actually how Rufus, Gary, and I met, Farrah said. We've told you about the zombie plague we all ended up fighting together. There was a temple of undeath at the heart of it all. The local mayor was the high priest. It was a massive debacle.
I've never seen that many undead, before or since, Rufus said.
I wish I could say the same, Farrah said,
Jason nodding his agreement. Rufus gave them both a worried look. The main building of Death's Temple proved oddly pleasant, with open space, plenty of light, and clergy wandering around in white robes.
This is not a place for the dead,
an acolyte explained, as he led Jason and Farrah through the halls while Rufus waited in the lobby.
The dead have already passed on, and their sacred remains are respectfully prepared for their ultimate disposition in the deep places of the temple. This place is truly for those who remain, a place to come together and celebrate their lost loved ones and the life that remains.
Death care is really exploitative where I come from, Jason said. Your goddess probably stops that kind of thing from happening here, right?
My goddess stops it from happening everywhere, the acolyte said.
Our definition of everywhere, Farrah said, is more expansive than what you're thinking of.
They were shown into an office, where a bronze rank priest got up from his chair to meet them. His hair and eyes were a matching sea-green colour, and he had an easy smile. He appeared to be in his 30s, which meant closer to 50 for a bronze ranker. Jason and Farrah shared a look.
I think I'm going insane, Jason said. People keep wondering, and now it's finally happened.
I'm sorry? The priest asked.
Your name isn't Al, by any chance, is it? Farrah asked.
Ah, the priest said. You must have met one of my brothers.
It's happening again, Jason muttered.
I'm Aldrich Alberici, the priest said, but everyone calls me Al.
You don't happen to have seven brothers, do you, Al?
Farah asked. I do, Aldrich said. Alvin, Alexander, Alan, Albert, Alistair, Alfred, and...
Aldrich rolled his eyes.
Alejandro. He's the sexy one.
You aren't all identical?
Farah asked. No, we are, Aldrich said. Mr. Asano, Miss Huron, please do sit.
Jason was shaking his head as he sat down across the desk from the priest.
Is he all right? Aldrich asked. He didn't come back from the dead a bit funny, did he? We get that sometimes.
You know who we are, Farah said. You know why we're here, then.
I do, Aldrich said. He took an envelope from his desk drawer and placed it on the table. Identity certifications for you both. It's quite unusual for people to both die and come back from the dead outside of our goddess's gaze. She is, however, still the goddess of death. The moment you entered her sphere of influence, she knew of each time you had fallen and each time you had returned. She instructed me specifically to ask that you be more careful, Mr. Asano. She may not know the details, but she is aware that death is becoming an unfortunate habit for you.
Yeah, Jason said wanly. Coming back from the dead is kind of my thing.
She would rather it wasn't. So please do her a favor and stop dying in the first place.
I'm doing my best, Jason told him.
Thank you for this, Farah said, taking the envelope.
Helping the living with the affairs of the dead is why we are here, Aldrich said. It's just that when the living and the dead are the same person, there's more paperwork.
As they were about to leave, something occurred to Jason and he turned at the door.
Al, he said, I don't suppose one of your brothers is a tailor.
Chapter 10. Multi-talented. Rimuros was a city of well-trained and powerful essence users, which meant many strong auras and powerful senses. With the number of essence users present in the city, and more pouring in for the monster surge, it was a disorienting cacophony for those able to sense it. This was one of the main reasons that aura retraction was a key point of etiquette. While any essence user could sense auras, detecting the senses of others being projected out required training. In Rimuros, the appropriate training was commonplace, which was why it was similarly impolitic for people to project their senses to the full extent. Jason appreciated the courtesy others showed in not blasting out their auras and their senses and returned the courtesy in kind. Standing in a crowd of adventurers, this was especially important. Jason, Farah, and Rufus were outside the administration building of the Adventure Society's main campus, which was the beating heart of the island of Liveros. Adventurers were streaming in from all over the city and beyond to register for the monster surge, and even the surrounds of the administration building was crowded almost shoulder to shoulder. Jason, Farah, and Rufus were stuck outside, waiting amongst the throng. Adventurers were being prioritized by rank by the Adventure Society officials managing the crowd, but there was no shortage of silver rankers. It was a big change for Jason after Greenstone and then Earth. In both places, silver rankers were high-ranking elites at the top of their respective societies.
Notice how there aren't any iron rankers around, Rufus said. In a true adventuring city like Rimuros, they're considered not much different from normals. If you aren't careful in their training, iron rankers can very easily die from the monsters that manifest in this region. It's why the training annex I've been building in Greenstone will be so valuable. Part of what has made the Gellers so successful is that they realized long ago that the prestigious high magic regions aren't better for everything.
Do you know if there's a branch of the Geller family here? Farah asked. Perhaps they could get word to Danielle Geller.
I'm not sure, Rufus said. It's certainly worth exploring once we're done with this mess.
Farah looked over at the bronze rankers, boxed out by the silvers being given priority.
Bronze rankers here, she said, are much like iron rankers in Greenstone. They're inexperienced and untested.
Here and in places like Vitesse, iron and bronze rankers are coddled. They have to be. When bronze and iron monsters do spawn here, it's in massive herds. They get thinned out and the low-rank adventurers are set loose on them. No autonomy, no spontaneity.
It's why we jumped at the chance to get out from under supervision and come to Greenstone, and what makes the training annex valuable. Farrah put a hand on Rufus's shoulder.
We know, sweetie. Your family runs a school.
Jason snorted a laugh as Farrah turned back to him.
Silver rankers like us are the true backbone of adventuring culture in a city like this, she explained. That's the rank where they can reasonably roam about without needing protection beyond their own team.
There are far more gold rankers than you'll be familiar with seeing here, Rufus said. But that doesn't make them common. They're called on at need. But for ordinary gold rank monsters, one or more teams of silvers are sent out. Maybe with a gold ranker leading a joint force. Actual gold rank teams are reserved for the largest threats, because calling on them usually involves an exchange of favors. Those rules shift during a monster surge, though, right? Jason asked. Very much so, Rufus said. During a surge, the golds put aside their interests and agendas and step up. They also aren't the last line against the larger threats, since diamond rank monsters usually only turn up during surges. That's when the hidden diamond rankers show themselves. You'll probably see a diamond rank monster yourself before the surge is done, hopefully from a very long way away. It's not the monsters that we're worried about, Jason said. We've seen worse than what a monster surge can throw at us. You're underestimating the surge, Rufus said.
No, Farrah told him. He's not.
It's the other thing the surge is bringing, Jason said, looking at the crowd around them. They haven't announced the surge's bonus feature yet, have they? Not that I'm aware of, Rufus said. I can hardly believe it myself, some of the things Dawn told us.
This certainly isn't going to be like the surges we remember growing up, Farrah said.
Both she and Rufus had lived to see two previous monster surges, neither while as adventurers. One had been while they were still toddlers. Rufus frowned at the crowd. Aside from dividing the crowd by rank, the society officials were organizing into three queues. Local adventurers from guilds were getting priority in the fast-moving line, with local adventurers in the slow-moving second line. Outside adventurers stood in the third line, occasionally spicing it up with a shuffle forward. I don't like your coming back during a monster surge, Rufus said. All I want to do is go off with you both and talk for a week.
This was always going to be the timing, Farrah said, regardless of when we came back. We shouldn't get into it out in the open, though. We'll tell you about it later.
We need to get this registration done, Jason said. Unless the Gellers can help, it's how the others will find us, since knowledge won't tell them. I still don't understand what Gabrielle said when we asked, Rufus said. Something about knowledge not being a something? I don't think she knew either.
An SMS service. She was talking about communication networks from Jason's world, Farrah said. I miss my phone.
You mostly just called me, Jason said.
It had my games. Shrubberies versus skeletons might have been a knockoff, but I maintain it was better than the original.
How much of my money did you spend on microtransactions again? Jason asked.
You say that as if you paid attention to money, Farrah told him. You didn't even pay attention to spirit coins after what you got from killing Dawn.
After he what? Rufus yelled out. Don't make a spectacle of yourself, Jason said.
We'll tell you about it later.
We really need to get to later, Rufus said. You said communication network. Are you talking about the magic item you mentioned that's like a water link chamber you carry around in your pocket?
It's not magic, Farrah said. We did use a bit of magic on ours, but most people don't.
How is that even possible?
Jason once told us that we would find his world as wondrous as he found ours, Farrah said. He wasn't wrong. The things they accomplish without magic are incredible.
They're starting to incorporate magic into them now, too, Jason pointed out. My world has less magic, but the combination of magic and technology will do a lot to close that gap.
It empowers normal and low-rank people much more than we see in our world, Farrah said. The societies in Jason's world weren't built by immortals with vast personal power. They have to accrue power through money and influence. But even the most powerful rarely live to see a century. There is an inherent difference in how people look at things.
Is everyone there like Jason? Rufus asked. He was growing concerned that Jason's world had somehow infected Farrah's mind.
No, he's strange everywhere, Farrah said. That's not a bad thing, though. The people from Jason's society weren't ready for the realities we face here, so the arrival of magic was handled poorly in a lot of ways.
Farrah put a comforting hand on Jason's shoulder. Jason had to step up and face challenges that people of our rank shouldn't have to. His family supported him, but they weren't ready to accept the steps he had to take to keep his world safe, what he had to become to take them, and the sacrifices along the way.
You did plenty for my world, Jason told her. You faced the monster waves, the army of the dead at Makassar. Without you, they may have never figured out how to repair the grid and bring the monster waves to an end. You did more than anyone actually from that world.
Jason, Farrah said, you're from that world.
No, he said softly. Not anymore.
By the time Jason, Farrah, and Rufus finally got into the administration building, it was well past dark. There was an array of officials directing adventurers, who took Farrah and Jason's identity certifications before Jason was directed separately from the others. Rufus and Farrah were a registered team and part of a prominent guild, even if they were a long way from the guild's seat in Vitesse. They separated, but the trio would keep in contact through Jason's party interface. Jason was led to a small office. He was met with by an Adventure Society official who waved him to the chair across the desk from her own without looking up from the papers she was reading. Her silver rank aura was marked by monster cores, marking her as a pure, albeit senior, bureaucrat. Jason waited patiently as she continued to read from the sheaf of papers in her hand, moving through one page, then another. Occasionally, she would shift her eyes briefly to give Jason an assessing glance. The office was magically sealed, and Jason's senses were blocked by the walls. He didn't try pushing them to see if he could get through the block, but he suspected not, given that it also cut off chat through the party interface.
Mr. Asano,
the official said, finally looking at him directly.
There are quite a number of irregularities in your record. Let's start with the fact that you're dead.
I provided a certification of identity from the Church of Death. I also have a personal crest you can check against Magic Society records.
I'm familiar with the documents I'm holding in my hand, Mr. Asano. Is this going to be an exercise in you telling me things of which I am already aware?
Jason forced down his instinctive response. She was clearly testing his equanimity. I apologize, he said, with a smile that didn't reach his eyes. This is a new process for me, and I've never operated in a city like this before. I'm unfamiliar with the scope and scale of operations here, and would welcome any guidance you were kind enough to offer.
You're an outworlder, she said.
Yes.
You trained in Greenstone and came into contact with several families prominent outside of that little provincial town. The Gellers, the Ramores. You were also present for an event in which many prestigious young people from around the world were competing for a prize, which you won despite the considerable talent in competition with you.
I had a Geller on my team and no shortage of luck. Your records are very thorough.
You were implanted with a star seed and made into a minion of the Builder before having the seed extracted.
Not that thorough, then. What you just said isn't accurate. I was implanted with a seed under unusual circumstances, but it didn't take. I got lucky.
You sound like a very lucky man, Mr. Asano.
I've encountered some good fortune, Jason acknowledged.
Did you meet anyone from Rimuros around the time of the contest?
Yeah, actually. All the teams were split up and we worked with who we could find. There was this bloke, defense specialist. What was his name? Keen? That was it. He was from some city here in the Sea of Storms. Not sure if it was Rimuros or not, but your city is spread out. It covers a lot of territory, so maybe I should look him up.
You, along with your team, made a second incursion into the astral space when it was unsealed a second time.
That is correct, Jason said. The first time was for the contest, and the second time was just my team.
The contest executed by Emir Bahadir.
Jason didn't comment on her choice of verb, simply noting it.
Correct.
And how would you characterize your relationship with Mr. Bahadir?
Friendly?
Would you consider yourselves accomplices?
I cannot speak to what Mr. Bahadir would consider, Jason said. As for myself, I would call Mr. Bahadir a benefactor. Gold rankers don't need iron rank accomplices.
I can think of many circumstances in which they would. That would be a failure of imagination on your part, Mr. Asano.
This doesn't strike me as a conversation where imagination will serve me well. He lied. She leafed through the papers in her hand, skimming the contents.
During the second instance, in which you entered the sealed astral space, your team encountered the Builder Cult.
Yes.
You fought the Builder Cult.
Yes.
And out of your team, you were the only one to die.
Someone has to be the worst, Jason said.
And your death was confirmed. Your team watched your body dissolve into smoke like a monster.
Jason's face fell. They saw that? He asked softly, voice slightly breaking. They saw me. They had to watch.
Yes, she said coldly. What if I put it to you, Mr. Asano, that you were still an agent of the Builder at that time, and that you turned on your team and were killed by them? That they only told others that you sacrificed yourself to protect their reputations? What would you say to that?
Jason felt rage rise inside him like a wild tide, but let none of it appear in his aura as he gave her another lifeless smile. I would say that unevidenced conjecture that impugns the reputation of a group of people who are objectively heroic for the very thing that makes them heroes is unbecoming of someone representing an organization like the Adventure Society. Further, I would say that, on a personal level, you are a petty, bitter, and envious little person who does not deserve the seat you are sitting in, if you were to put it to me.
Where have you been for the last 2.5 years, Mr. Asano?
Home. See the family. You know how it is?
Would you care to elaborate?
No.
I see. How did you come back from the dead?
It's kind of my thing.
That is not an answer.
I spotted that too.
The more forthcoming you are, Mr. Asano, the more we can help you.
Where I grew up, we call that kind of sentence a red flag.
Your initial contact with one of our officials raised several questions. You were noted as being suspicious.
I am suspicious. We've just gone through my enigmatic past, so you know that better than most. I'm a man of mystery.
A past on which you refuse to elucidate.
A girl's got to have her secrets.
You aren't painting yourself in a good light, Mr. Asano.
That's kind of my thing, too. I'm coming to realize it's something I'll just have to accept about myself.
You deceived our contact agent. He listed your race as human, not outworlder.
I was testing out some aura manipulation on Vidal. Self-manipulation. I was affecting myself, not doing anything to him, just to be clear. He was extremely professional, observant, which is why it didn't go so well for me. My friend told me that I should just be myself, which is probably a good lesson for all of us. She shuffled to another page of the documents in her hand, looking it over.
Yes, Miss Curran. She also died quite some time before you, in another astral space, in another fight against the Builder Cult. How did she come back from the dead?
Well, I was coming back from the dead myself, so not bringing her with me would have been rude.
Your familiar is a shadow of the Reaper, yes? And not just any shadow, but the very one that had, for centuries, previously managed the astral space in which you died.
Yes.
Is it responsible for the resurrections of yourself and Miss Huron?
You caught me, Jason said. My bronze rank familiar brought both me and my friend who had been killed an entire year previously back from the dead.
If not that, then how?
I told you. Coming back from the dead is kind of my thing.
You seem to have a lot of things, Mr. Asano.
I'm multi-talented.
So I've read,
she said, once more looking to the papers in her hands.
Stealth, utility, mobility, self-healing, cleansing, drain attacks, that's a lot of things that aren't afflictions for a so-called affliction specialist. It seems that you're quite the dilettante.
Cleansing is affliction-related, affliction-adjacent at the very least. Besides, I like to think of myself as versatile.
No one cares what you think, Mr. Asano. I'm referring you to our Builder Response Team for assessment as a potential threat. If you are cleared, you will be assigned an action quota. You will need to report regularly to the jobs hall, where you will be assigned contracts in order to meet this action quota. Is this understood?
Yes.
Given the breadth of your abilities, you will be a liability for most tasks due to your inability to dedicate your disparate powers. You have mobility, navigational, and storage abilities, so I'm marking you down for solitary missions, delivering supplies to isolated, non-critical areas.
I heard that team-based operations were the standard here.
You are not from here, Mr. Asano. Do you have a problem with the tasks to which I am assigning you?
Not at all, Jason said. It sounds like those people could use some help and maybe they aren't getting the attention they need. Given how busy things are, I'm happy to pitch in. The official stared at him silently for a moment.
An admirable attitude, she said finally. If it's genuine. Outside this office, you will find a small security team who will escort you to our builder response team for immediate assessment. If they fail to clear you, then what contracts you may or may not want will no longer be an issue. Good day, Mr. Asano.
Chapter 11. Don't say you weren't warned. Jason stepped out of the assessment office to find a stern-looking man and woman waiting for him. They each had a rigidly controlled silver rank aura.
So, he said, are you two generic security, or are you part of this anti-builder unit?
We are part of the builder cult response team. Come with us, please.
Absolutely, Jason said.
Take me to your leader.
The pair escorted Jason through the vast administration complex, down through multiple basement sublevels that grew increasingly grim. As they went, Jason felt a large dead zone below them, where his senses stopped cold. Even more than the aura-blocking office walls of the assessor, this was a sealed environment. He was brought down to the same level as the dead zone, which began at a wall with a large metal door. It was thick and heavy, reaching from floor to ceiling and covered in intricate ritual markings. Perhaps Farah could have made sense of them, but they were far beyond Jason's ritual expertise. Looking at the door, he got the sense of a magical bank vault. There were two guards outside the door. One stood to the left of it, with the other inside a secure booth to its right. Both of Jason's escorts had to place their hands up against the glass of the booth, where a previously unseen ritual circle lit up with a green glow. After seeing the glow, the guard in the booth nodded at Jason's escorts. The guard by the door spoke into some kind of communications device and placed a crystal into a slot in the wall beside the door. The guard in the booth did the same on the other side, and the cumbersome metal door slowly descended into the floor. Jason's escorts led him into the wide and high corridor of plain brick behind it. Not exactly a cheerful work environment, Jason observed. You should get some potted plants in. Ones that don't need a lot of sun, obviously.
Introducing outside materials is a potential point of compromise, the female escort told him.
That sounds like a super fun workplace.
After passing into the corridor, Jason entered the dead zone. His senses extended through the place, but now everything outside it had been cut off. His perception was still politely withdrawn, but the subterranean complex wasn't especially large, so he could sense everything within the limited area. There were 2 gold rankers and 14 silver rankers, including his escorts. Most notable were 9 people with builder star seeds inside them, each of which had their auras strongly suppressed. They were in poor condition and all separated, suggesting they were probably prisoners. Jason hoped that was the case, rather than the builder having infiltrated the anti-builder task force. There were also people in a similarly poor state who were converted. Rather than a star seed, they had been implanted with a clockwork core, modifying them into bizarre amalgams of metal and flesh. These weren't the damaged and repurposed clockwork cores of Earth superheroes either. Fully intact cores turned people into something between victim and minion of the Builder. Jason had seen the results when he and his team fought the Builder in the past, when the cult had converted their allies amongst the clergy of purity. This replaced essence powers with less potent physical transformations, but raised their rank, trading long-term growth for immediate power and obedience.
Jason's escorts led him down several corridors of dark grey brick and through multiple steel doors before stopping in a large room. It looked like a dungeon set up as an office, complete with a heavy wooden desk and a man chained to the wall. There were no chairs on the visitor side of the desk. Instead, there was only a large ritual circle, permanently set into the floor in brass and multicolored crystal. Jason recognized the ritual, realizing it was at least one of the means by which they were testing people for builder connections. Chained to the wall, the restrained man's body had metal rods jammed into the torso, arms, and legs. The rods covered in glowing runes from which small amounts of mist was rising. Jason got the impression of something being drained from the man, and he could feel the rods suppressing the starseed inside him. The other occupant of the room looked up from his desk as Jason and his escorts entered. He was a gold ranker that looked no older than his early 20s, but only the most oblivious person would mistake him for being Jason's age. There was an air about gold rankers that even normal rankers with no true aura sensors picked up on, even if they mistook it for charisma.
"Thank you. Stay by the door, please," he told the escorts in a clipped military voice.
They nodded respectfully and closed the thick metal door before taking positions on either side of it. The gold ranker then went back to the paperwork on his desk and scribbling notes in a book. He hadn't so much as looked at Jason. Jason shrugged his shoulders and moved over to the man chained to the wall, stepping around the ritual circle set into the floor. The prisoner hung limply, eyes open but not seeing. He wasn't dead, but in some kind of catatonic state.
"Your decor is a bit garish," Jason said. "I was talking about some potted plants with your employees, but that's clearly not the ambience you're going for."
"You find this cultist condition confronting?" the man asked, without looking up.
"I've been worse," Jason said absently, peering at the rods jutting from the prisoner's flesh. "But you know that."
"You mean seen worse."
"Do I?" Jason asked, without looking away from the prisoner.
He tapped one of the rods with his finger.
"The ability to suppress star seeds without them self-detonating was something they were still working on when I was last in this world. It really came along."
"You've seen them detonate before?"
"I have, but you know that too."
The man finally looked up, although Jason didn't turn to face him, still examining the catatonic prisoner.
"Then why don't you tell me something I don't know, Mr. Asano?"
"Because I'm not going to start satisfying your curiosity when you haven't even told me your name."
"Most people show gold rankers more respect."
"When all I've received is suspicion and rudeness.
I'm here so you can determine if I'm a builder puppet.
I haven't been proven one yet."
"If you had, Mr. Asano, I think you'd have seen that your treatment would go beyond rudeness. Stand in front of the desk."
Jason turned around.
"You mean walk willingly into your ritual circle, thereby making myself subject to its effects?"
"Yes."
"I don't think that's a good idea."
"I didn't say please because I wasn't asking, Mr. Asano."
"I'm just saying that if you want me in a soul projection ritual, you might want to use a smaller one."
"You're familiar with soul projection rituals?"
"It's not the first time I've been suspected of being on Team Builder. I'm getting sick of telling you things you already know, but that's fine. Just don't say you weren't warned."
Jason stepped into the middle of the room. The gold ranker raised his hand and chanted a few syllables that weren't from any language, simply sounds to help establish a mindset and focus the magic. The ritual activated, and Jason felt his aura unleash itself, not just at full strength, but fed power and amplified by the ritual. The gold ranker's eyes went wide as the air turned thick as syrup and the glowstone in the ceiling dimmed. Murky darkness filled the room and figures appeared within it. The figures were floating dark cloaks, speckled with stars. Inside the cloaks were what looked like portals to places filled with sunshine and blue sky. Around the cloaks were other things, blacker than night. They darted about, quick and sinister. The two guards by the door had pressed themselves into the corners of the room, their faces stricken with fear. The man chained to the wall roused from his stupor, eyes clearing as he started thrashing in his chains and screaming a word over and over.
"Rejector! Rejector! Rejector!"
The gold ranker cancelled the ritual, and Jason drew his aura back in as he casually adjusted his floral shirt. The prisoner continued screaming until the gold ranker marched over, grabbed his face, and slammed his head back into the wall, knocking him unconscious. The gold ranker then went to the closest guard, huddled in the corner. He yanked her to her feet, and then did the same for the other. The door burst open, revealing a gold rank woman.
"Keel," the newcomer said. "What are you doing in here? Whatever that illusion was, it sent the prisoners berserk. The ones with cores all had seizures, and the ones with seeds woke up and won't stop screaming."
The original gold ranker Keel turned to Jason, who had a plate in one hand and a fork in the other.
"What?" Jason asked. "I just remembered I had leftover strudel."
Jason was taken into a small, secure room with metal benches set into the stone walls. Inside, Farah was already sitting down.
"Sure thing, Farah," she said to Jason. "I'm going to lay low and not make a fuss. Nice and quiet, that'll be me."
"I told the guy to use a less powerful projection ritual," Jason said. "Have you found these people to be great listeners?"
"The lady I saw was nice," she said. "Is that strudel?"
"I just remembered that I had some left over."
"Splitsies?"
"Definitely." Jason sat down next to her and produced another fork. She grabbed it and he held the plate between them so she could dig in.
"They thought you might be a builder puppet too?" Jason asked, as she groaned happily around a forkful of fruit pastry. She nodded.
"How long do you think this will take?" he wondered. "They'll probably just leave us sitting here for a while and watch us."
Farah threw Jason a curious glance, and he pointed at a brick in the wall that looked like any other.
The two gold rankers, Keel and Liara, watched Jason and Farah through a seeing stone as Jason pointed it out.
"That man is trouble," Keel said.
"Yes, but I don't think he's a servant of the Builder. Just the opposite, if anything. You felt that aura, just like I did. Its very nature rejected the star seeds and the clockwork cores. You were right about Asano. Whatever he's been through did something to him, something that we can use."
"Perhaps. He's still only silver rank and won't be able to help against the larger threats."
"I'll take something that works against the medium threats," Liara said. "And what was with that aura? Is he another fourfold?"
"No," Keel said. "His aura is just that strong."
"How? That strength was practically gold rank.
I'm pretty sure his aura had things still I couldn't sense properly, even with the projection ritual and his being a lower rank than me. That was the touch of the divine in there, right?"
"His contact with gods was in his record. It's nothing we didn't know."
"What about the woman?" "Her aura is outworlder now instead of human, but clean. She doesn't have a personal crest, though, so we'll need to do some more identity verification. We did get something on the power screen ritual. We found traces from a builder blessing, but it wasn't like the ones we've seen from cultists. This was custom. The thing is, though, every racial gift she has evolved through a blessing."
"The builder shouldn't be able to bestow more than one blessing."
"It didn't. Each of those was from a different great astral being. They're relatively common from the Reaper and the Celestial Book, but the World Phoenix, not so much. As for the Legion and the All-Devouring Eye, the last I heard, they didn't hand out blessings."
"Check that with the Magic Society."
"Oh, I intend to. But whatever is going on with her, I don't think she's in the Builder's camp. The other beings wouldn't bless her like that if she was."
"The Builder only blesses its own people."
"Keel, I think we can safely say that Miss Huron falls outside of normal circumstances. And she didn't lie. Did Asano?"
"I don't know. Couldn't read his aura until it was projected, and I didn't stop to question him once it was."
"Did you power screen Asano before the soul projection?"
"No. We know he has a Reaper blessing, but after what his aura did to the prisoners, I'm not going to bother. I'm convinced he's clean. As you said, exactly the opposite of in the Builder's camp."
"Which means she probably is as well," Liara said. "We should hold her until we've confirmed her identity at least. I have more records coming from the Magic Society, so it shouldn't take long. The paperwork from the Church of Death helps."
"That leaves the question of what to do with Asano."
"I say we stick with your original intentions and make use of him, both of them."
"He won't make for a reliable asset, and we don't know what the Builder is up to yet."
"Let me run Asano," Liara said, Ostensibly, we leave him be, for now. Eloise assigned him to solitary delivery missions, as directed. After what we just saw, I think we can dangle him on a hook and see what comes for a nibble.
What was Eloise's assessment? Keel asked.
He handled provocation well, but he was aware of what she was doing. He showed anger when she pushed, but she thinks it was a show. With that aura of his, she couldn't read him properly. He's smart enough, but he has impulse control issues and trouble keeping his mouth closed. He has some connections, but nothing local, as far as we can tell.
As far as you can tell? Keel asked.
The name, Jason Asano. I feel like I've heard it before, but I can't remember when.
You have the memory of a gold ranker, Keel said. If you can't remember, you're either imagining it, or it was of incidental importance.
I don't know, Liara said. It's been bothering me.
Go through his records if you like, Keel said. I'll hand him over to you entirely. I have this feeling that I'd end up killing him.
Chapter 12. Contribution. Late into the night, the space outside of the Adventure Society's central admin complex was still crowded with people. To Jason's delight, some enterprising local vendors had wheeled carts into the Adventure Society campus that magically expanded into food stalls, creating an impromptu food market. Since he and Rufus were still waiting for Farrah to emerge, they roamed around, sampling local delicacies. The streets were lit up not just with plain streetlights, but also different coloured glowstones that painted the primarily white stone buildings and tropical plants. The Adventure Society campus had plenty of wide boulevards and open spaces, which the people and the vendors gave a festival atmosphere.
It's good that people are enjoying themselves, Rufus said. If Dawn's warnings hold true, there are dark days for all of us ahead.
Nope, Jason said. I've had quite enough of dark days, thank you very much. If the Builder and his creepy steampunk cyborgs want to make things crappy for people, they need to go through me. I'm appointing myself the defender of cheerfulness, friendly barbecues, and nice afternoon naps. You have to help, by the way.
I'll do my best, Rufus said, with a chuckle.
They said Farrah should be out within an hour or two, Jason said. They're waiting on more information from the Magic Society, though, and I have to imagine that delays are more likely than not with all these people swamping the admin staff.
I fear you're right, Rufus said.
Why is it so crowded? Jason asked. The Monster Surge announcement is only hours old. Do even the locals get only a day to sign up?
No, they get more leeway, Rufus said. They still want to get registered as quickly as possible, though.
They want first pick of contracts while everyone else is still signing up?
That's part of it, Rufus said. The real prize is the contributions leaderboard. Did they explain that to you?
Is that like action quotas? Jason asked.
They explained those.
Action quotas are the minimum requirements every adventurer has to fulfill during the Monster Surge, Rufus said. The contribution board is an incentive system to keep us going beyond our quotas. All the contracts you take, over and above your quota, are assigned a contribution point value. Contribution points are tallied on weekly and overall leaderboards, with rewards given out at the end of each week, and then major rewards at the end of the surge. And those rewards are worth going for.
So it's not all about duty, then.
It would be nice if every adventurer did their part, because that's what being an adventurer is. Not everyone is your friend Humphrey, though. A little incentive goes a long way, and the incentives on offer aren't that little. All the major societies, associations, and governments give out hefty rewards during a monster surge. Of course, they get benefits as well. They all have interests that need protection, and in return for their generosity, the Adventure Society assigns high contribution point values to the contracts that provide that protection.
Don't the big guilds monopolize the top of these leaderboards?
They do, Rufus said. But that's okay. Guilds are looking for more esoteric rewards than cash or magic items. They want access to civil services, organizational benefits from the Adventure Society, Magic Society, Alchemy Association, and the like. Material reward don't mean much to the top guilds because they're already able to get their hands on anything money can buy.
I get it, Jason said. All the material rewards are lower-rung prizes.
Exactly, Rufus said. They land right where the small-time guilds and independent adventurers can get their hands on them. Plus, the guilds earn their rewards. Not only do they need to reach the highest points on the contributions, but they have the highest quotas to beat before they even get on those boards. Jason and Rufus were eating deep-fried sausages on sticks. In a city like this, Rufus continued, gesticulating with his food, about 3 in 10 adventurers are in a guild. 1 in 10 is in what's considered a high-end guild. And that's not even counting all the outside adventurers coming in that make their numbers an even smaller slice of the adventurer pie. Yet guilds are given 60% of the quotas to fill. Guild adventurers enjoy more privileges than their independent counterparts, but the monster surge is when every adventurer pays back, no exceptions. The guilds will be wringing themselves dry over the coming weeks. Jason was peering at his half-eaten deep-fried sausage on a stick. "This meat is pretty great," he said. "It's like a saveloy, except it doesn't taste like the animal died in vain." "This isn't meat," Rufus said. "It's made of vegetables."
"This is made of vegetables?" Jason asked, pointing at his food. "This thing here."
"Yes," Rufus confirmed. "It's a mashed sausage."
"There are vegetables here that taste like this?" Jason asked, shaking his head.
"I like ratatouille as much as the next guy, but my world got ripped off. Vegans would love it here." "What's a vegan?"
"They need to let Farah out," Rufus said, sounding bloated. "At this point, I'm fairly certain I've eaten my body weight in food. Let's hear it for converting organic material into autonomically mutable biomass," Jason said.
"Were those dumplings sweet or savory?"
"Both," Rufus said. "As in, they have both sweet and savory dumplings, or each dumpling is somehow both sweet and savory?"
"Actually, don't spoil the surprise."
Even in the small hours of the morning, the area around the main administration was still full of people. While Jason was waiting in line for dumplings, Farah was released from the sealed underground complex of the Builder Response Team and contacted them via voice chat. She, like Jason, had been stuck eating spirit coins for most of the last 2 years and took to the food stalls with the same enthusiasm he had.
"You never used to mind living on spirit coins," Rufus said.
"You never used to wax your head,"
Farah shot back, before happily biting into a grilled sandwich.
"I don't wax my..." Rufus shook his head in resignation.
"What are we doing now?" he said, firmly changing the topic.
"This city might be lively at all hours, but that doesn't make this a great time to go hunting for a place to stay."
"We'll hit the water," Jason said. "We can stay in the boat overnight while we travel to Arnott and find a place in the morning. Then we can just portal back to Liveros to take contracts."
"Or shop," Farah said. "I'm surprised you haven't run off to grab some crystal wash, Jason."
"I do have some self-control, you know."
Rufus and Farah shared a look.
"What?"
Jason asked them.
"Jason," Rufus said, "what did you do?"
"I didn't do anything."
They both gave Jason a flat look.
"I didn't do anything,"
he said again.
"I'm just glad people are so open to magic in this city."
"What does that mean?"
Farah asked. After Shade turned into a shadow boat that carried them out to sea, Jason had used the cloud flask to create a yacht. Shade took the helm and steered them towards the island of Arnott. Jason and Farah were enjoying the luxuries of the cloud vessel, many of which were unusual to Rufus.
"I'm not sure I understand this music," Rufus said. "Why are people shouting at this pale boy to play music?"
"To change rock and rolling minds," Farah explained. "It's a self-explanatory song."
"Exactly how thorough was the Adventure Society's identity check?" Rufus asked, narrowing his eyes at her.
While Rufus was familiar with the many amenities of Emir's cloud flask constructs, and while Jason's lacked many of the same, it did boast some that Emir's did not. This was a result of feeding the cloud flask elements only available in Jason's world, including quite a lot of technology quintessence. The result was a variety of effects that could be replicated with magic, but were made more convenient with a technological aspect. For example, the extensive media collection in Jason and Farah's recording crystals could be accessed via menu screens. As Farah and Rufus were catching up while Farah shared her new musical tastes, Jason was on the upper deck, laying out a magical diagram.
One of Jason's happy discoveries in his short time on Liveros was that such a cosmopolitan magical city was open to all manner of unusual situations. This included shadowy familiars being seen as perfectly acceptable customers so long as they had the power to communicate and sufficient coin. In the time Jason had been dealing with the Adventure Society, Shade had been roaming the city's night markets. Along with other critical supplies, he had purchased the required materials to resummon Jason's familiar, Gordon. In Rimeros, finding the materials to summon any silver rank familiar was a question of money rather than time. Jason had looted his way through proto-astral spaces, monster surges, and transformation zones, the more numerous and high rank of which came after he stopped supplying the network with funds. As a result, Jason's coffers were, relative to a silver ranker, at Scrooge McDuck levels of overflowing. Monster surges represented a specific economic cycle. While the surges were costly to communities, the rebuilding afterwards was always a stimulus. Governments funded the rebuilding, the money largely sourced from special services offered to adventurers and the Adventure Society. With the increased looting opportunities that surges brought, there was no shortage of demand for such services. Jason had been going through what amounted to concentrated private monster surges for years. Outside of family wealth, only a gold ranker who had been operating for a decade could compete with Jason's current prosperity. Colin, in the form of a Jason lookalike blood clone, stood next to one of Shade's bodies as they watched Jason prepare to reunite their little family. Jason carefully completed the ritual circle and chanted out the incantation.
When worlds end, you are the arbiter. When gods fall, you are the instrument. Herald of annihilation, come forth and be my harbinger. I have doom to bring.
Under the night sky on open water, the stars were bright. The city island of Liveros was beautiful at night with its cornucopia of lights, but without the light pollution. The sky was a sea of twinkling lights ruled by the twin moons. As Jason completed his ritual, the light of the moon and stars dimmed as darkness shrouded the boat. Eventually, the light was fully expunged, but darkness was no obstruction to Jason's sight. Two motes of light appeared over the ritual circle, one orange and one blue. More lights appeared, slowly at first, but accelerating until the individual motes became a cascade of blue and orange radiance. It swirled together to take the form of an eye-like nebula that was a match for the ones in Jason's eyes. Finally, the light coalesced into Jason's last familiar, a dark cloak draped over the nebula and orbited by smaller nebula eyes. Jason broke into a huge grin.
Welcome home, mate.
In the early light of morning, the cloud yacht approached the island of Arnot. Jason was on the deck cooking breakfast with ingredients that Shade had picked up in the night markets of Liveros. Fair warning, he told the lounging Rufus and Farrah. I don't know what most of this stuff is, so it's going to be trial and error for a while. The Sea of Storms was calm, with no sign of storm's magic or otherwise. After breakfast, as the cloud yacht pulled into a small port, Jason stretched his arms out lazily, finally feeling like himself again. Eating actual food, fresh from a crystal wash shower, and with trusted companions by his side, he felt at home on this unfamiliar sea in a way he never had on Earth. Miles Cotesy looked up as Humphrey and his team, plus hangers-on Gary and Jory, filled his office.
"Do you have any idea what you've asked me to do for you?" he said without preamble. "How busy I am right now!"
They had returned to Vitesse, aboard a builder airship they casually picked up along the way, which the Magic Society had been thrilled to take off their hands. The team had immediately scooped up contracts that others had passed over for being a pain, portaling around to clear a half dozen of them in 2 days. Their behaviour made it obvious that they had wanted something from the outset, and they sought Miles to get it through. Travel dispensation to an as-yet undisclosed location during a monster surge was no small request.
"Asking for a status update on a dead team member is weird," Miles said without preamble. "And another from your team, Mr. Zandia, which involved some administrative hoops given your inactive status with the Adventure Society.
Fortunately, your prompt registration for the Monster Surge brought you some goodwill in the eyes of the Society.
You have news? Humphrey asked.
You know, Humphrey, I thought you took after your father. You seemed like such a sensible young man. It turns out that you're your mother's son after all.
He asked if you had news. Sophie said, placing both her hands on the desk sitting between them.
Calm down, Sophie, Miles told her. It does seem that you are right. Your dead team members have arisen from the grave and are alive and well in Rimuros, in the Sea of Storms.
The group shared looks of relief and joy.
I made another discovery along with information, though. Mr. Zandia, your other team member, has registered his participation in the Monster Surge in Rimuros alongside the other two.
Rufus is there already?
Gary said.
How?
You now know as much as I do, Miles said.
Rimuros is on the other side of the planet, Clive said.
Yes, Miles said, which makes obtaining a travel dispensation quite the task right now.
Is there anything you can do? Humphrey asked.
Of course there is, Miles said. It's me. Clive, the operation that was delayed when you were sent away is not only back on, but has been given priority. You pull this off with the kind of success you outlined in your initial proposal, and I can get